Morning. All right, let's go ahead and open our Bibles to Acts chapter 21. Okay. So we've moved on from Paul's missionary journeys, and we're into his time in Jerusalem, and he has arrived there with his companions, primarily Gentiles. This is going to play an important role in what happens here in Jerusalem. And we started last week chatting a little bit about his reception by the church. And the fact that he had the kind of initial congregational welcome, if you will, and then had the opportunity to meet with James and the elders. I call it kind of the business side or the business meeting. And last week, we ended up with kind of discussing some of the things that the people in Jerusalem had heard about Paul. Primarily, the things that Paul was rumored as teaching the Gentiles to forsake Moses and his teachings, and of course to not to circumcise their children nor keep any of the customs, but completely abandon all of that. Well, those were obviously in error in the extent that Christianity is applied, and we'll talk about that here in just a bit. But one of the problems that I think that the church in Jerusalem was really trying to deal with was this issue of division. And we're going to see that issue come up again. As I've mentioned before, and I'll say it again today, and because it's important to understand as we work through these next several verses, is that the book of Acts really is a story of how the church increased in its maturity and understanding. Because, of course, in the early days, say Acts chapter 2 days, the church was really pretty limited in its understanding of all the doctrines of Christianity. The concept of the new creation, I'm sure, was out there in some way, shape, or form, but you really didn't see a lot of that writing being distributed until after Paul had written most of it. And so it was really wasn't until the end of the first century that a lot of that information was readily available to the church at large, just as an example. So, for the sake of context here, let's start in Acts chapter 21, verse 17. And I'm going to, again, read this from to the end of the chapter because I'm hoping to get through this today. But again, the context here is really, really important. So let's go ahead and pick that up here in verse 17. After we arrived in Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. And the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and the elders were present. After he had greeted them, he began to relate one by one the things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they had heard it, they began glorifying God, and they said to him, "You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. And they have been told about you that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children nor to walk according to the customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Therefore, do this that we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take them and purify yourselves along with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads and all know and all will know that there is nothing to the things which they have been told about you, but that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law. But concerning the Gentiles who have believed, we wrote, having decided that they should abstain from meat sacrificed to idols and from blood and from what is strangled and from fornication." Then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself along with them, went into the temple, giving notice of the completion of the days of purification until the sacrifice was offered for each one of them. When the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law and this place, and besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. For they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian in the city with him, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Then all the city was provoked, And the people rushed together, and taking hold of Paul, they dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. While they were seeking to kill him, a report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. At once, he took along some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them, and when he saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came up and took hold of him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. And he began asking him who he was and what he had done. But among the crowd, some were shouting one thing and some another, and when he could not find out the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. When he got to the stairs, he was carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. For the multitude of the people kept following them, shouting, "Away with him!" As Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Then you are not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" But Paul said, "I am a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city, and I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand, and when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying, okay, we'll stop there. So, remember this situation. Paul arrives in Jerusalem. He's not there very long. We talked about this last week, that he had the opportunity to meet with the elders, and the elders have a plan for helping to resolve this issue that they see arising because of Paul's presence there in Jerusalem. Now, remember, what time frame was this that Paul was in Jerusalem? What was going on in the city? Yep, it was really close to the day of Pentecost, which means what? There would have been more or less people in Jerusalem? Significantly more. Like a large number of people in Jerusalem of primarily Jewish descent. Okay? And many of them, as James had told Paul, many of them had converted from Judaism to Christianity. But as you know, and as we saw there in verse 20, they are still all zealous for the law. Okay? So they have, here in verse 22 through 25, they have a solution. They have some recommendations, or at least they hope they do. There is no doubt that all in Jerusalem, whether they were Gentiles or Christians or Jews or Jewish Christians and the Sanhedrin, they knew or would hear of Paul's arrival in Jerusalem. This is something that James actually says here in verse 22. By the way, anybody have New King James or King James Version that they read all the time? Because you'll notice that there's a difference in the verses here. Scott, would you mind reading that verse 22 for me, please? Here, let me get the mic. Sorry about that. I'm putting you on the spot.
I got to find it here real quick. "What then? The assembly must certainly meet for the way, for they will hear that you have come."
Okay, so the assembly must certainly meet. Anybody else's Bible say that? Nope. Not a big deal. But the King James Version is probably the only English translation. Actually, to my knowledge, the King James and the New King James are the only English translations that have that phrase in there. As we talked about a little bit before, it's a little bit of a side note, but just to kind of store away in your brain when you might come up against or see these differences. The King James Version was based on the writings of Erasmus, who based his translation on the Byzantine text source. So the Byzantine text source comes from about the 9th century. It's the most prolific because it was written on animal skins. And so the Byzantine text is what the King James Version is based on. Okay. There's three sources, but the other primary source is the Alexandrian texts. They are from the 2nd and possibly into the 1st century. There's some discussion specifically on the book of Mark that we might even have some evidence that is yet unproven. I think it's for political reasons personally, that dates from about the mid-first century. We have some copies of that, mid to late first century. So, at any rate, the Alexandrian texts, yes?
Clarify, those listening online what you mean by Byzantine, where that's coming from, what area of the world?
Sure, sure. The Byzantine texts are primarily from the area around Rome. That's essentially what they would have, where and one of the reasons why they're used. The Byzantine texts would have come from the southern coast of the Mediterranean Sea, and along the northern coast as well, where the Alexandrian texts came from, like Ethiopia and further into Africa. Okay, I didn't write all that down, so I'm going off memory.
That's all I want to make sure they
true. So the whole point of this is that the King James Version is the only English translation that uses the Byzantine text. That's why you're going to see differences in it. I don't think that this changes necessarily the intention of the verse by adding in that the assembly must meet. I think it was Erasmus's assumption that added it in there. So at any rate, so you'll see that the New American Standard, and like I said, pretty much 99% of the English texts use the Alexandrian and don't include that phrase. So I just bring that up so in case you come up and see that, you'll know a little bit of why that is the case. So one of the things that's happening here is that because everybody would hear about Paul's arrival here in Jerusalem, and because of the things that they've been told about Paul, many people would wish to speak with him or at least hear him speak. And others would wish to silence him without hearing anything more. That's usually the case. And as we'll see and as we read, we know that that's really what ended up happening. People really didn't want to hear more. They just wanted to silence him because of the rumors that they had heard about Paul. Just a quick question. Has anybody ever heard about where you go to church and gotten the wrong idea? Yeah. I remember when my mother-in-law, when she first heard about where we were going to church, and I don't think she Googled it necessarily, but because this was, yeah. What's that? Yeah, I don't know where she got the information, but maybe somebody else gave it to her, I don't know. But of course, I think there was a Time article about years ago or something about how the Church of Christ is a cult. And of course, her perspective was very different. She was Baptist in that regard. But anyway, it happens all the time. And thankfully, my mother-in-law, over the course of a few years, figured it out and became a Christian. And, you know, thankfully, she's in heaven. But the whole point of this is that this happens all the time. And we do it in our own lives, whether it's related to religious perspectives or not. We have the tendency to hear rumor and make assumptions and then act based upon those assumptions that are based upon rumors that we haven't taken the time to prove to one way or the other. So it's very common with man. But one of the things that the elders were trying to do here is that they were trying to correct the falsehoods here and demonstrate Paul's recognition of the former authority of the law of Moses. And he was going to do that by purifying himself along with these other guys who had taken a vow. Now, we've talked about this a little bit before. This was most likely the Nazarite vow. If you get the opportunity, it's Numbers chapter 6. We're not going to read it for the sake of time. But Numbers chapter 6 covers the Nazarite vow. And one of the things that they asked him to do was to pay their expenses at the completion of the vow. Now, this is rather interesting. A Nazarite vow was required commitment. There's a number of things that went along with it, but it was also expensive. Go back to Numbers chapter 6 and read of the sacrifices that needed to be made for each person. These weren't just, you know, pocket change kind of sacrifices. It was going to be expensive. So this was a way for Paul to demonstrate that he wasn't trashing Moses and the law, but that he was holding still to God's plan. Now let's talk about these four men for a second. Where were they from? Don't know. What were they involved in? Don't know. Why did they take the vow? Don't know. But what we do know, they were probably Christians. Keeping a Nazarite vow. Huh. These four men were Christian converts. They, based upon their connection with James, I mean, James says, we have these four guys. Okay? The adherence to the Jewish rites, like the Nazarite vow, it illustrates that the church was still very young and not entirely enlightened on the doctrines of Christianity enough to forsake those ceremonial rites. So as I mentioned, this is an excellent example of how we understand that the church, as they were growing, they were increasing in knowledge. And at this particular point, this is where James steps in and he says what he says about the Gentiles in verse 25. It seems very out of place until you consider the fact that these four guys that were keeping the Nazarite vow were Jews. And then James jumps in here in verse 25 and he essentially repeats what was decided upon in Acts chapter 15 at the council in Jerusalem. If you go back to Acts chapter 15... we'll start here in verse 19, but this is, of course, James writing this letter to the Gentile churches. He says, therefore, it is my judgment that we do not trouble those who are turning to God from among the Gentiles, but that we write to them that they abstain from things contaminated by idols and from fornication and from what is strangled and from blood. Verse 29 in the same chapter, he repeats that essentially. But if you go over back to Acts chapter 21... you'll notice that, as I mentioned, James says this in the middle of this discussion. Now, again, I want us to put ourselves in this situation. Pick one. Imagine yourself as either a Jewish Christian or a Gentile Christian, and pick a side. You show up, whichever side you picked, you show up to Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, or for the feasts, and you see the other side not doing what you're doing. Because if you're a Jewish Christian, you may be keeping some of the things of the law. You may be partaking in a Nazarite vow. You're probably going to go to the temple, and you're probably going to engage in all the sacrifices and take part in those things. If you're a Gentile, you're not. So, what is this doing? And now you have millions of people in Jerusalem, some who are keeping the law and some who aren't in that regard. This is not something that was necessarily building unity amongst the church, but it was an issue that they had to deal with. So, as a little bit off the subject, but you can see why the book of Hebrews was so valuable in helping them understand that the law was gone, that the requirements of the law were fulfilled in Christ. But that's a whole other discussion. All right, so this was something that they had to deal with because the Gentiles weren't required to keep the law. And that's why James throws that in there. But they were to keep the ordinances from the conference in Jerusalem, to basically don't participate in pagan sacrifices and pagan rituals, etc., etc. So there were some significant obstacles to unity caused by this approach. The church had to grow out of this. And they weren't quite ready to do it yet. Now, there's a lot of opinion on what James and the elders should have done because this didn't turn out as they thought it would. And others would say that, well, James and the elders were just trying to please men. So they did this. Well, I think what they were searching for was the opportunity to ultimately preach the gospel. And that's why they did what they did. And as we saw when we read through it, it doesn't exactly turn out as they hoped it would. And that's because you can't always predict the actions of other people. Okay? So, Paul agrees to do this. Okay? And the next day he enters the temple with the four men, back in verse 26. So then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself along with them, went into the temple and giving notice of the completion of the days of the purification until the sacrifice is offered for each one of them. So Paul does this. He takes himself, he's been purified with them, and he goes into the temple, and he announces the date in which the days of purification would end, and offerings would be made for each of them. So, you're going to have to make your comment because I can't remember what I was going to say.
Paul's not being inconsistent here. Not at all. If you look at his letter to the Colossians, chapter 2, verse 16, maybe you could read that. It helped people understand. He always was determining what's the best thing to do based upon the current circumstances. But I'll read Colossians 2:16. He says, "Therefore, no one is to act as your judge in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day." They're all shadows, but he says, no one should be able to judge you on what you do with that.
Actually, that's one of the verses that I have written down. And no, thank you for getting to that, because we're going to cover that in just a sec. But here's the thing that regarding the Nazirite vow, remember I was going to say, there's a seven-day period of purification in the Nazirite vow. Okay, so you go in, if you go back to Numbers chapter 6, it's in the last half of the chapter, it's about verse 14. The person who was keeping the vow was to go in and shave their heads, burn the hair, and then there would be a seven-day period before the sacrifices would be offered. So this is why he goes in, and this is why they put it this way, because you'll see in verse 27 that the 7 days were almost over. Okay? So there are three views concerning Paul's involvement with this vow. And these views are from commentators. Okay? And these are, and interestingly enough, I think every single one of the commentators use King James. At least from what I could tell. But that's a whole other story too. So there are three different views. One particular view is that Paul acted ignorantly. That he wasn't aware that the law of Moses was no longer binding. And this, I am not kidding. I'm not exaggerating. And I think this was Matthew Henry's commentary. I might be wrong. I think it was Matthew Henry's commentary said that Paul acted in ignorance by taking part in this. It is absolutely unbelievable to me that they would even assume that. This is completely unlikely, since Paul very well understood, and you can see that in his writings. Colossians is a good example. But he preached the whole counsel of God. He understood. Acts chapter 20, verse 27, right? And, of course, this is also unlikely because Paul, by this time, had penned Romans, which helps you understand the law and how it relates to the Christian. 1 and 2 Corinthians, a little bit about that. And how about the book of Galatians? Already written these letters by then, okay? And these clearly reveal that Paul was not ignorant in his participation in this particular vow. And this is from the commentators that believe that Paul was, in my opinion, that they believe that Paul was bipolar. That's a very common thing that you'll see if you do any research on the book of Acts and Paul's writings. A lot of people believe that he was bipolar. And Luke and I had a study with a few guys years and years ago, that their Bibles were highlighted with two different colors. All the New Testament writings that had anything to do with Paul or anything that Paul wrote. And on one hand, they were like, okay, he's sane here and he's insane here. I mean, that's essentially the way they approached it. Made it really difficult to have a Bible study with them because they were nuts. But anyway, this is absolutely outrageous and unlikely. They're thinking that Paul acted like Peter did, in Galatians chapter 2, where Peter holds himself aloof from the Jews. This is unlikely. Paul had endured so much mistreatment already. He would not have done that. And of course, it's unlikely since Paul was willing to be bound and to die for Christ. So it's not at all reasonable to assume. I'll get with you here in just a second, Super Dave. It's not reasonable to assume at all that Paul was being hypocritical here. And the third, of course, is that Paul acted consistently with what he actually taught, which is the right view. And you see this pretty consistently throughout the Scripture. The law was no longer in force. Paul made that clear in Romans, Galatians, Colossians, Ephesians, Philippians. He made that very clear. He understood it very, very well. Anyone seeking to be justified for the law, by the law, through the law, was fallen from grace. Galatians chapter 5. Paul knew very well. He understood that very well. Yet a Jewish Christian like Paul could observe the customs of the law. Okay? So a couple of examples. Let's just jump over here to Acts chapter 18. We covered this a little bit, but this is really where it, I think, is the most applicable for the lesson. Acts chapter 18, verse 18. Paul, having remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria, and with him were Priscilla and Aquila. In Cenchrea he had his hair cut, for he was keeping a vow. Probably the Nazarite vow. Okay? And how about this, besides the Colossians one? Let's go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. I think 1 Corinthians chapter 9 illustrates very well Paul's approach to the things of the law, and also things that have nothing to do with the law, for as long as they're done for the right reason. Okay? 1 Corinthians chapter 9, let's start here in verse 19. He says, "For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, so that I may win more. To the Jews, I became as a Jew, so that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law." And then he goes on and talks a little bit more about the Gentile aspect. Did he write 1 Corinthians before or after these events? Before. It's almost a little prophetical. I mean, it's not. But it's interesting to see how he writes these things, and then he's consistent when he gets in Jerusalem. He didn't condemn James and the elders for asking him to do this, because he understood that this would provide an opportunity to preach the gospel to the Jews once again. And the largest gathering of Jews in the world. It was a great opportunity, and Paul was willing to do what needed to be done in order to take advantage of it. Super Dave, you had a comment?
Yeah, you covered most of it on 1 Corinthians, but I was also going to say that it's no different than when he refused to circumcise Titus, but he circumcised Timothy. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a consistency there. There is a reason for it.
Yep.
You know, and Paul knew when and where to apply those actions.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good illustration. Mikey?
I've heard, it was either Luke or maybe Kevin, I've heard someone said this over the years, that don't be so heavenly that you're no earthly good.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, Kevin's giving the credit to Luke. And that's a good point. And the whole point of this particular discussion is that Paul understood what the right thing to do was. His desire was to preach the gospel. His desire was to free people from the bonds of sin and death, and from the condemnation that they would encounter under the law. So, a Jewish Christian could observe the elements of the law, provided he did not do so seeking justification from the law. That justification comes only through the sacrifice of Christ. And as long as that Jewish Christian did not bind it upon others, especially Gentiles, who were never under the law of Moses. This was one of the deciding issues in Acts chapter 15, about the whole circumcision thing. This is what they came up with, essentially. Like, you can believe whatever, just what Colossians 2 says. You can believe whatever you want. You can do what you want. I have to be careful in that. You can do what you want as long as it's in accordance with the Scripture and in accordance with a sincere heart and faith. But you can't hold it to somebody else. Okay? And this is really what Paul was illustrating by taking part in this sacrifice. Okay. Any comments or questions? Got a couple? Okay.
Well, one, you did a very good job of laying that out. And two, sometimes it's easy for us to think that, well, this same idea is prevalent today, that Christianity is laying aside the commandment. And so they hold to an Old Testament perspective as they continue to strive to follow Jesus. And it can be easy to pick on the Worldwide Church of God, Seventh-day Adventists, those groups. But, I've noticed that there is this kind of new trend coming out, with the New Covenant, Messianic Judaism, New Covenant type, Old Covenant stuff. It is kind of making a push. And it's because people have a really hard idea with the comment you just said that, okay, you're going to do this Nazirite vow thing, that's fine, but don't think that you're seeking God's justification by it. It's through faith. And then people are like, well, okay, well, you mean you can do whatever you want? Because even in your own comment, Jared, you had to say, be careful. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what these people are saying. They're saying, wait a minute, you guys are saying you can do whatever you want? Like, that leads to licentiousness.
Right.
Okay, so the only other way the pendulum can swing is to law. Mm-hmm. So then they go back to Leviticus, right? So it's more prevalent than you would think. And so they're struggling with this idea that somehow we're just ignoring the commandments. Mm-hmm. We can do whatever we want, right? And so Raj made this comment last week, and it's a really good comment, and I just wanted to add on to it. What we need to be able to explain to people is that, one, in Jesus' own words, he said, I did not come to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's important. But it's in that section in Matthew 5 that we're taught that we arrive at a standard higher than the law. It's not that we're trying to say you can do whatever you want and then it always leads to licentiousness. We're saying this is how we seek God's justification by faith. It's not possible through the law. Okay? But we didn't leave the commandment, do not murder your brother, right? Jesus says you can't even have hate in your heart towards him.
Right.
Okay? You have heard the ancients were told. What's Jesus talking about? Talking about the law. Mm-hmm. He says, you have heard that you cannot commit adultery. He's like, I say to you, anybody who looks at a woman with lust in her heart is just as guilty. Like, and that's just an important concept. We arrive at a position higher than the law
mm-hmm.
by not coming at it through the perspective of the law, but through the love of God. But make no mistake, we are under a far higher set of quote-unquote rules.
Mm-hmm.
We can't even lust towards and it's sin in the eyes of God. And so if you read Matthew 5 there, I mean, he's just going bang, bang, bang. You have heard, you have heard, you have mm-hmm. heard. And he's explaining Jesus stepped it up.
Yep, indeed. And the reality of this is that, it's to use an analogy, it's a bit like saying, well, I'm going to put a roof on my house without ever putting the foundation down. And the foundation of the law was there so that we could understand what righteousness was really about. And the only way that we can overcome the requirements of the law is through Christ. So, thank you.
Well, I was going to point out that you cannot legislate morality. And so liberty, people get a misconstrued idea about liberty. Mm-hmm. It's really about moral people being free. And only a moral people can be free because they're taking a check on themselves. You don't have to have the stop sign. You don't have to have the uniform. You don't have to have the whistle to call you out because you're constantly checking yourself. And so the idea today, though, is that they can legislation do new terms so they can get money. And I think that's probably not only breaking up the nuclear family, but also so people can get covered by medical expenses because of outcomes that they've practiced.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what everyone's got to understand, that if you're responsible for your actions, that you are going to pay for your actions. And that's where the law does come in to judge you. And so I don't want to be under that type of form or system. And so we're being forced, maybe even literally, into a regime. I do know that Christians can survive under any political atmosphere that happens because at some point, death is inevitable anyway. So if you're not complying because, the king tells you to bow down at the statue, hey, heat the furnace up six times. I don't care because I am going somewhere where I know that I can be free and under a just king.
Yeah. Amen to that. Lots more we could say about that for sure, but we'll save the political discussion for later.
You know, in regards to Nolan's comment too, Jesus makes it very clear throughout the four Gospels that you know we are to abide by the commandments, but he also says that the two most important is to love the Lord your God with all your mind, body, and soul, mm-hmm. and the second is to love your neighbor as yourself. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing that, then you've got the rest of the commandments covered.
Yep. And Kevin.
This is all there in the book of Acts and the letters so that Christians understand we get to make decisions on a daily basis predicated upon circumstances and opportunity, what becomes priority and what we do or don't do. I can remember that Kathy and I, when we would go visit my youngest brother out in, when he was in the Bellingham, Washington area, we used to go to a Church of Christ, and I believe they were non-instrumental, Mount Baker Highway, Church of Christ, whatever. And one Lord's Day, my nephew was playing in a Christian band or whatever you want to. He was playing for some church service. Mm-hmm. And they were obviously pretty, I don't want to say, they were quasi-charismatic. And he beseeched us to come. So we had to make the decision, are we going to go to this Mount Baker, which was pretty wishy-washy, probably leaning a little bit more towards law type attitude, but pretty wishy-washy. Or go and hear our nephew play and look at that as what's the opportunity down the road. Mm-hmm. We made the decision not to attend that Church of Christ. We did break bread by ourselves, but we went where our nephew was, and my conscience was completely clean that day because I knew why I was doing what I was doing. And, you know, some would say, oh, you forsook the assembly of the saints to go listen to your nephew in this false church. And I, you know, yeah, you could, all right, you can say that. Whatever. My conscience is clean. I know why I went. I know what my motive and my intents were. They were all pure.
Yep.
And so to the pure, all things are pure.
And Paul will make that essential very statement soon. Yeah, so... good discussion on that. We're not going to get through Acts chapter 21 today, but that is just fine. I'd actually rather have the discussion than not. So let's jump back to Acts chapter 21. Just a couple of... let's see if we can get through this in the next few minutes. All right, so Paul is arrested in Jerusalem. Verses 27 through 30 there. We read through it, so I'm not going to again... But why was it that he got arrested? We'll just cover the high points here, but why was it that he got arrested?
Because they had seen Trophimus with him in the city and assumed that he took him into the temple.
Yep, that's a big portion of it. And so remember, I talked about the companions that had traveled with him, that they would be a source of fodder for the Jews who were against him. The other thing I want you to get out of this is that who was it that initially stirred up the crowds? Jews from Asia. Where's Ephesus? It's in Ephesus. Think they... why were they there again? Oh, that's right. They were there for the day of Pentecost and for the feasts. So you think that they knew who Paul was, and they knew who his companions were, and... Although I hate to assume that they were plotting this the whole way from Ephesus to Jerusalem, they knew where Paul was probably going to end up, and they were like, if we see this guy, this is how we're going to set him up. Now, I got a question for you. If you have somebody that is from lives in a small town out in the boondocks, and you bring him to the big city, what are you going to do with him? Especially if they're coming to see something that's really pretty magnificent. Guess what? You're probably going to give them a little bit of a tour of the town. Walk them around and say, there's that building over there that's really cool, and that bridge is really cool, and this park is awesome. I would bet that Paul did a little bit of that. with these Greeks that he brought from Asia and Macedonia. He probably walked them around the city a little bit. Hey, here's the temple, and this is really cool. It's beautiful. Isn't it awesome? Okay. I bet he gave them a little bit of a tour of the city. And the Asians were like, hey, there's our opportunity. So these Asian Jews were the ones who stirred up the mob, and the accusations that they made were not uncommon, and they had been used successfully to stir up the crowds in the past. Acts chapter 13 and Acts chapter 14, both instances where the Jews basically said the same thing and stirred up the crowds and got Paul either stoned or run out of the city. Okay? We're just going to stop there because we're not going to get through it all. But any closing comments or questions? All right. Thank you for your kind attention.